Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter, and my co-hosts are Marisela Garza and Cheryl Lindemann, and we have the great pleasure of ordering the majority of Capillary District Library's collection. Hey, ladies, welcome back. Spring is theoretically coming. It was sunny when we first kind of looked out.
Now I hope so. I left my coat in the car.
That's interestingly hopeful. We are in Michigan. So how is your reading month, or what's it looking like going forward? How's it going?
Yeah, it's going
nice.
Well.
We're a little bit punchy today. I think we had a punchy pre-podcast conversation. So yeah.
I think the world is just wild and interesting right now. That's all there is to it.
What is emo music really?
We have a lot of side topics we can talk about if the podcast doesn't go well. No. Now, the reading is going all right. You know, I think I've just been allowing myself to do a mix of my own personal TBR pile, and I have one new release from 2025 this podcast. So, yeah, just kind of a mix of different things. I think I'm still committed to the goal of pulling in my own personal TBR and trying to get through some of those, because I always push them aside for new books. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to do a mix of this year.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Maddie?
I'm doing great. I have been reading mostly nonfiction for children and sprinkling in some humorous titles. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm not going to talk about really many titles on the Audie's list, but that just came out. And I realized that one of the books I'm talking about, which is super funny, reading it, is also available in audio. So I just added it to our Overdrive cart, Jessica, just in case.
Yeah, we will order it. Yeah.
All right.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's one of my goals.
Yeah, having a really nice end of winter, just reading things here and there that are mostly short, but occasionally meatier titles.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Excellent.
It's also, we not necessarily on a theme, but there are things that worked that way. It's Women's History Month. It's also March's Reading Month.
Yeah.
So there's things that you'll see we are promoting throughout Cattle. But I think we can sort of get started. My first book is a little bit of a jump off from last podcast. I want to talk about Lone Women by Victor Laval. I think it's at least a couple years old. But my book discussion group, the Downtown's science fiction, speculative fiction reading group, just did it. And it was a great discussion, but it was a really interesting read. Lone Women features a woman who had been homesteading with her family in California. And her parents die tragically and mysteriously for the reader at the beginning. And she has decided she's going to relocate to Montana, where it is possible for women to homestead on their own, single women to actually get a homestead on their own. So she's decided, and there's a real pamphlet that this was sort of based on. It's a woman wrote kind of encouraging people to come, women specifically, to come and homestead in Montana because they would be able to do that on their own. But she is, it's about generational trauma and a lot of other things as well. This is a young Black woman, and not that young. She's, I think, in her 30s at this point, Black woman. She is taking her burdens with her, and you don't know what her burdens are, but she has this steamer trunk that almost nobody can lift. She can move it, but she, needs to drag it to the pier when she takes her takes the boat around to the Washington State area to then take a train into Montana. And she drags it to the pier, but it takes four men to get the trunk onto the boat. So it's just sort of one of those weird things are happening in this book. As I said, this was for my speculative fiction group. This is, I would say, kind of creepy psychological horror. There's other kind of twists in it, but it really looks at kind of the other in communities, in homesteading communities. So it's it's a single Black woman. It's a single mother with a child in a nearby homestead. It's a lot of immigrants with their own ideas and beliefs. It's setting up a community, taking advantage of a young Chinese woman who is doing the cleaning, running a cleaning business. But then, you know, you have more quote unquote normal Americans moving into the area, then you don't need the others as much, and they're just sort of different. So you've got this weird kind of mentality kind of coming across and how these people react to it. But on top of that, you have a magical element. So it's creepy. It's well done. I just thought it was a really interesting read, and I really like Victor Laval's work. So that's awesome. My first one.
Wow, cool. So I have the next book. This is Mari. It is March is Reading Month, and I love going back and looking at especially like favorite chapter books, early chapter books for kids. And the one I'm talking about today is Cat Wings from Ursula Le Guin.
I love Ursula.
Oh my gosh, it's just adorable. I mean, this is a book that was published by Scholastic, I think back in 1988. So we are going back almost 40 years, not quite, but... it is just adorable. It is, it's got really great illustrations by Schindler, S.D. Schindler. And it's kind of, I might say definitely like a first entry level into fantasy. It's about a cat family. There's four little kittens who were born with wings. And Mrs. Jane Tabby, I think her name is the mom. And they live in the city, and lately they've been having trouble with like really fierce rats, and the sparrows have moved out of town, and there's like no food. And Mrs. Jane Tabby is kind of interested in moving on to find her next husband because he's her the cat father left the family. And she's got Mr. Larry Cat, who's asking her for marriage, and she's got these four little kittens, and she knows that they're going to need food. And so she's kind of like, come on now, you're going to have to go off to the country. And they fly away, basically pushing them out of the cat nest. it is just a beautiful story. And I have to tell you, too, that there's four that were published. There were two online additional ones that got added in there. But the four, I think it's Cat Wings Return, The Return of Jane. I can't remember the name of the third one, but these are just beautiful books. And the reason I'm bringing them up is because we get a lot of questions sometimes in our branches about, like, you know, after picture books, after early readers, what can that second grader or third grader read that isn't, like, too hard or too... mature or advanced in content. And this is the perfect little chapter book series. I mean, some people do describe it as a picture book, but it's really a chapter book series. There's four chapters in the first book, Cat Wings. And I just cannot talk enough about it because it's very old school, if you could say. Like, the cats call the cat mom, like, okay, mother. You know, there's just all these references, like just a really old school sort of addressing of your parents. And it's just, I really liked it a lot. So I hope that, especially if you're a teacher, a parent, even a child out there listening, that you will explore the Cat Wings series by Ursula Le Guin.
Oh, lovely. The cats are so cute.
They are. They have wings.
Yeah, it's precious. The illustrations are beautiful. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to another direction here. The next book that I have, I'd say that all of my books do kind of fit the women's stories, I should say, theme.
Right.
So all the things I have today are women's stories. There's in different formats. So I have two memoirs, but this is the first one. It's called A Flat Place, and it's by Noreen Masood. And there's also a subtitle of, I have the English edition that I bought in England, but the American edition is Moving Through Empty Landscapes, Naming Complex Trauma. They spelled that out more in the American edition. And what this is by the way, I should mention, it was longlisted for the Women's Prize in England. It's been highly acclaimed there. Nori Massoud is a professor of literature at Bristol University. And this is an extremely unique memoir. I would really recommend it for people who love nature memoir, who love really introspective memoir, very deep memoir, and who are okay about reading about stories about trauma. Because it includes all of those elements. And what's so fascinating about this is it's not a sentimental nature memoir, which as much as I love nature memoir, it's my favorite genre. However, this is a departure from that sentimentality. It's very open, honest, direct, real. And ultimately, the tie in this story is between flat places in nature. So there's so much reverence for mountains and hills and seasides and that sort of thing, but flat places, really flat landscapes. And the flat landscape is sort of a metaphor. This is a little oversimplification, but it's hard to describe this book. It's a metaphor in some ways for trauma, for a place to hold the trauma in a way that isn't traumatizing but is healing. So for Noreen Massoud, she grew up in Pakistan, in Lahore, in this very intense urban environment, in a claustrophobic, kind of horrible family environment with a really overbearing and abusive father. And when she would go, they had bars on the windows, they were closed in. And when she would go out to do activities out in the world, they would pass this really flat space, this really flat field. And she would glom onto that every time, and it would soothe the anxiety in her. So moving forward, she's exiled from her father, exiled from her family. She goes with her Scottish mother and her sisters back to the UK and pursues her education there. And she's drawn to flat places. And she has CPTSD. So there isn't one specific event. And in some ways, she contrasts that to nature. There isn't this mountain to climb and get through. It was so much kind of lower simmering trauma, right, that it takes her a long time to even figure out why she's constantly having panic attacks and that sort of thing. So this is a story of healing, but of coming to sort of a safe place and trying to heal through these landscapes. Mm-hmm. So you go to the Orkney Islands. This really wonderful place that I'm blanking on. It's, of course, the Ely Fens around Cambridge and Cambridgeshire. Orford Ness, which is really, really interesting. The Newcastle Moor. Morecambe Bay, which is beautiful. And so it's just a really, really unique memoir about mm-hmm. nature and mental health and ultimately about hope.
That one sounded really, very interesting.
Yeah.
So I have the next book, and this one is we kind of went back and forth. We've talked about it a little bit, Cheryl and I, actually quite a bit. And I'm not entirely sure why I first picked this one up, but this is Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother by Peggy O'Donnell Heffington. In some ways, it might have been slightly political because being a mother or not being a mother came up in pre-election discourse and who had a say in going forward, what we do. This is just a really interesting history and exploration of the role of not being a mother. And in the Heffington kind of goes circles about kind of how to phrase that, the child-free can be loaded. Unable to have children can be loaded. The various ways to kind of say it. And there's kind of pointing out there's lots of reasons that people either have children or don't have children. There's lots of not everybody can, not everybody wants to, not everybody is made for that, whatever. But it's just a really interesting exploration of how, for a very long period, that's just a role in community, and not everybody did. It's sort of a different kind of more recent, like the creation of the nuclear family has had its own kind of effect on how the two if you set, call it two sides, the people who have children and the people who don't have children react to each other or work with each other or don't work with each other. It's just a very interesting book that looks at how connected we are or not connected we are to. But it was just, it's just fascinating. It talks about, you know, it goes through, if you think about it, you know, she just, you know, just take a look at the, from my occupation's point of view, you've got Jane Austen, George Eliot, the Brontes, Louisa May Alcott, Emily Dickinson, Edith Wharton, Virginia Woolf, Gertrude Stein, all single, not having children, Harriet Tubman, you know, I mean, various people adopted or had nephews and nieces living with them at different times and things like that. But these are all people who kind of pursued, for whatever reason, their plans and dreams, but also did not have children. So it's just a very, it's actually a really fascinating read. It's a really good audiobook. I listened to the majority of it, actually. She pulls from a lot of different people's occupations, people's place in the world. But it's just an interesting read. And it's, I think, worth sharing with people who have children and people without children.
Yeah, that sounds so good. Yeah, it's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually a relatively quick read, too.
I think we talked about, you mentioned Haggitude in that book by Sharon Blackie, and that's one that I read last year, actually, and, and she's child, does not have children, and she writes a whole chapter kind of talking about
And that. We talked about Bonnie Doe's, too,
yes,
too
That sense. I mean, yeah, exactly. So it's really interesting. Well, I'm going to move from that to another memoir, and this one is the 2025 book that I'm talking about today. I think you'll see this on some end of year lists. I think it's a really powerful, really uniquely crafted memoir. It's called How to Share an Egg, A True Story of Hunger, Love, and Plenty by Bonnie Riker. And this is sort of a story within a story. So you have a memoir that takes, you know, starts in childhood and goes up through adulthood of Bonnie being the youngest in her family, sort of a really kind of happy family. They're Jewish. They live in Canada and they own some restaurants and they're but she's always been the sensitive one. And she's the baby who's too sensitive. And she's plagued by nightmares. And they're fueled a bit by these little tidbits of a story that she is told about her father's survival from Auschwitz. And just little bits of it. And he, as she develops as an adult, she becomes a writer and goes to cooking school. So food is really intertwined in this book. But she becomes a writer and her father's like, okay, I need you to tell my story. And she is so traumatized by thinking about the Holocaust that she just pushes it away all the time. And she actually ends up having such bad anxiety and nightmares that she gets diagnosed with intergenerational trauma, which is something that we're hearing about a lot more. And she's sort of the carrier of that. Her sisters aren't. They're more able to like move about the world, but she's just so sensitive, she holds it in. And so this book is about her life, her coming of age, her development as a chef, and about how food links them together. But then at the very end, you get her father's story, and she finally tells it within her own memoir. And it is extremely harrowing. And he lost all of his family in the concentration camps, except for his cousin. And he escapes, kind of flees in this barn, and then they were freed from the camps. You know, here's the American soldiers actually freeing, and he ends up making his way to Canada and builds this life. But part of his survival is extreme optimism. He's like, all right, okay, that happened. I don't have any of my family. Let's move forward. And so he makes this own family, and he wants his children to be so happy. He's just a beautiful man. He's 94 at the end of the book. And he's just this kind of spry, happy, older man. And that was sort of his way of dealing with it was, I'm going to make this amazing life for my own kids. But the trauma's still there, and it's sort of moving around in the family. So it's really harrowing but really beautiful book and a lot of really great food writing. Food is food is it? The egg is what he shared with his cousin. It was one of the first items of food that he had after escaping the concentration camp. He also ate a whole jar of relish when the American soldiers came, because that's all they really had for some reason, and he got really sick, but that was what he ate. So, How to Share an Egg by Bonnie Reichert.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. All right.
Okay, I've been looking forward to this.
So I have a book. It's a nonfiction book for children. My presentation today is about the anaconda by Bibi Dumontak. Bibi is a Dutch author, so this is a translated work. The illustrations are fantastic by Anne-Marie van Heringen, and it is translated by Nancy Forrest Flyer. But this is a book where you've got a series of animals that are telling you, giving a presentation about other animals. It is so funny. I just had to laugh. It is pretty meaty, I'm going to tell you that. So I do hope that any child who picks it up really sticks with it, because there's about 20 different animals talking about other animals. And it is just, it's kind of cheeky in that it's, these are animals that are just giving you little tidbits about others. So you've got the cleaner fish, who is talking about the shark. You know, sharks have a reputation for being seriously bad guys. They eat fish and octopuses like there's no tomorrow. But to us cleaner fish, they look like torpedoes, and they chase away their prey through the water. It makes us chuckle to see how other fish panic when the shark shows up, you know? And cleaner fish run their own cleaning service right from home. By home, we mean the coral reef. You know, it is just constant, just that sort of humor. You learn from the fox that there's lots of different geese. You know, they mentioned the gray-leg goose, the barnacle goose, the pink-footed goose, the snow goose, the Egyptian goose. Wow. The lesser white-fronted goose. And as far as I'm concerned, a goose is a goose. They're all equally tasty. They're easy to creep up upon from behind, but you better be careful, because those birds happen to spot you, they make a big racket. You know, it's just very descriptive in that way. I laugh because I remember as a child having to give presentations about such and such. You know, you're called upon, you know, your teacher says you have to give a 3-minute presentation on this country or this animal or something. And I'm just picturing these animals doing these sorts of things. And one of the reasons at the beginning, I think it says something like, well, we decided that we were going to tell our own stories because y'all aren't, you know, doing it justice. I don't know, something along those lines. The anacondas and the earthworms, they do look alike, but they are not alike at all. In fact, actually, they're really not alike at all. You know, the worm is a worm, but the anaconda is actually a snake. And they can both wriggle around, but they don't have legs. Their skin is smooth. We both prefer moisture to dryness, but that's where the similarities end. It's just that sort of conversation. And the spreads are about maybe 2 to 3 pages long. Mm-hmm. It's got illustrations of the various animals. Really, a really cool book. Hello, is it my turn? Or is it the Gila monster on his way? No, I should begin then. You know, that's how I'm going to end it there. I just thought this was a really humorous book, and I actually can't wait to listen to it because it is going to be in our Overdrive collection soon.
Cool. Very cool.
That's super fun. Well, we like to take a little time out to talk about different topics in this sort of segment of the podcast every month. And I wanted to give a shout out, I guess, to periodicals. You know, I feel like that it's an area where in the years that I've been a librarian, which is about 23 or so or somewhere up there, I don't even know, periodicals have really taken a nosedive, you know, in some ways. You know, imagine all the magazines, you know, media was so different. I remember the magazines I loved when I was a teenager and that sort of thing. A lot of those are just totally gone. I remember Jane magazine for a while. I mean, just like all these magazines that have come and gone. And however, they're still going. And I feel like there's definitely a following with a lot of periodicals. Sure. And Cattle still has a collection of print periodicals, and they're in our locations. Every branch has a selection of some. The larger branches have more. And so it's something to check out if you're still interested. We still check them out to our members.
And
we also have a digital collection as part of Libby. So that's another option. And, you know, some of those are the only way that we can get a hold of certain materials, or it's the broadest way for us to get a hold of a bunch of different kinds of magazines. So I'm actually often fascinated by the breadth of the Libby collection.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It took me a while to kind of adjust to doing magazines on a device. I don't find them particularly useful on a phone, but if I'm working on a tablet or a computer screen, they're perfectly fine for me. And it sort of just depends on what I'm looking for. But when I make, I was just telling actually the librarians about this, when I make the lists for Libby each week, especially when I'm doing the nonfiction lists, I will kind of incorporate a variety of the Libby magazines into the collection as well. So a week ago I did, it's also National Embroidery Month of all things, and it's, I think it's National Craft Month too, and I did a craft list on Libby and just pulled up, I don't know, maybe 25 different embroidery magazines within the, and I didn't realize there were still 25 different embroidery magazines, you know, embroidery and craft magazines available. It was, there was a good chunk of the list was magazines that you could get a hold of for things like that. So the breadth within Libby, I can't tell you off the top of my head how many different magazines are in there. And both physical and digital, there are things that we can't get and there are things that are cost prohibitive. Those of you who have put in purchase suggestions for things and been told we couldn't get them, that really is an issue sometimes. Yes, I was going to say, yes. And some things that were in Libby and got taken out of Libby, it's all kind of contractual, and that's, you know, we do what we can do. It's a kind of an all or nothing thing with that particular collection. We just sort of get the whole collection as it is, as they put it together, and we can't really argue to get additional. We can make suggestions, but again, that's a sort of a contractual thing that Overdrive works out. But so it's really interesting in the what's available and what's not. But I've been pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, there's a lot of international content in there, which is things that you can't get here in physical format.
True.
Or if you can finally find it, it's, you know, $13 an issue or something like that. So it's worth checking out. And if you're looking at a story, you can click on it and turn it into a text format, even if it's on your phone. So you can pop in and out of the visual format, which is super small, into a text reader. And that really helps with actually reading the articles too. Well, I have one more thing to tie into this. I don't think we've ever talked about a magazine story, except for maybe the ones that were in that science collection that I talked about last month. But I actually came to the story through social media. And it's funny to me now, I kept reading and reading and reading and reading this story. And it's because it's 21 pages long, because I have the physical copy of the magazine now. And I realized, and it kept jumping me out, and I'd have to start all the way over and scroll down to where I was. But I read the most phenomenal story that I have to tell you about here today. It's out of the New Yorker. It's out of the New Yorker's 100th anniversary edition. So I came across this article actually on social media, and so I jumped over to the New Yorker site, and I had a free article that I could read that month, and I read this thing. It was like, I think it took me like about 40 minutes or something. I didn't realize how long it is. Well, now I have the print copy of the 100th anniversary edition of the magazine. It's from the New Yorker, February 17th, 24th, and 20-something there. And I got this at our Hazlitt branch of Cattle. And this article was just phenomenal, and I'm not surprised because it's by Lawrence Wright. And Lawrence Wright is a New Yorker writer, but he's also written a lot of books, written about Al-Qaeda, he's written about politics in Texas. But the book that I loved and gushed about when I'll never forget it, is called Going Clear. It's about Scientology. It is a tome. I mean, it's a huge book, but it's amazing. It takes you all the way from L. Ron Hubbard all the way up through, you know, Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, and more. It's all there, and he's like a religion, I think religion and politics are his focus, but he does religion well. So to this story, it is called Sisterhood, The Nuns Trying to Save the Women on Texas's Death Row by Lawrence Wright. And it's about a convent or an order of nuns called the Sisters of Mary Morning Star outside of Waco, Texas, and a deacon named Ronnie Lastovka. And then it's about the women themselves on death row and how they formed this the nuns form this group of service with the deacon, and they go and they minister to these women, and they got to know them very intimately. And the bonds that they had, you get to hear all the stories of the women, some of the misapplications of justice that they suffered from. You kind of learn about some of their innocence. It's about forgiveness, about redemption. Lawrence Wright pulls his own story about his own wrestling with religion into it. It was just a phenomenal piece. So I recommend that you check it out. Mm-hmm. But check out our magazines. And, you know, it's kind of like if you check them out, they will stay a little bit with those kinds of things. Because I think with declining usage, we have to eliminate magazines over time. But I do encourage you to check them out because it does help them mm-hmm. kind of stick around in our collections. So
yeah, and I will tell you, I've gotten a couple of fun ones that I've found in Libby. We get internally as librarians, there's a magazine called Booklist that is reviews and library ALA-related information. But they put out a kind of public-facing magazine called Booklist Reader that's really for it's to promote titles, to tell people what's hot, it's useful for librarians, but it's something that you can look at and sort of see what's coming and what's hot. But also one that a patron at Okemos pointed out to us after an event called Simple Things is in there.
Yeah.
And it's fun to actually hear what people are using really just one of those really pretty magazines with
magazine.
But it has a literary component to it as well. So it's cool. It's very interesting what's in there.
Yeah, very cool.
All right. So my last title for the podcast this month is The River Has Roots by Amel Almohtar. I absolutely love her writing. She was one of the co-authors of This Is How You Lose the Time War, which I read when it first came out, but it also went viral in the last couple of years because some wonderful person finally read it and said, "What are you all stopping at? Please go read this right now," because it's beautiful, weird, a wonderful sci-fi fantasy romance novella that they wrote, and it's wonderful. But this is actually her first solo novella release, and it's not long. It's short even for a novella, I would say, but she packs so much into this. It is a fairy tale story about a family right on the border, living in the human world, but right on the border of fairy. And there's this river that kind of is the border, a river and a set of trees that are sort of really the border. And it's the book is about language and how language is created, and it has some of its roots in this river. It's about music and the two sisters of the border family sing to kind of both appease and celebrate the forest and the river and the fairy world. It's about music. At its heart, it's kind of a murder ballad story based in murder ballad stories. There is a slightly jarring tragic event at the beginning, but it, in its own weird way, it all works out. But the way that she works all of these things into such a short, packed story is really quite impressive. I was able to kind of interview Amel as she was at a panel that I moderated last year, and it was very interesting to hear her talk about it. She's from a musical family. She used to sing with her sister just as part of family, and so that's a background to it. I'm really the book just came out the beginning of the first Tuesday of the month, and I really wanted to track down the audiobook because she wasn't sure whether the music would be a part of the audiobook or not, but I really want to see how that kind of landed because it's just a beautifully written, interesting story by itself, but the musical element to it is all very interesting as well. So I'm really enjoy her writing, so I hope people will give it a try.
Okay, I have to ask here, it may be very ignorant. What is a murder ballad? What would you consider that?
So it's those stories where there is often there's a romance, it goes wrong.
Okay.
Somebody is killed. In this particular case, it's not a stretch to say one of the sisters is killed. She has a connection with the fae and the fairy, and they are able to save her, sort of. She can be fine if she goes fully into their lands, but to go back into the mortal world, they decide to make her into a instrument that will be able to speak the truths of what happened to her.
Okay.
And so in this case, that's the angle. And there's old English versions, there's Appalachian versions. I mean, it's in country music. It's
I've heard
in,
it, but I yes. wasn't quite sure. Like, what is that? Okay.
Interesting. Country music.
Very much. Yeah. I mean,
that makes sense. Yeah,
for sure. The one that comes to mind for me right now, and I actually cannot remember the title of it right now, but because I saw Jason Isbell, who is a Americana folk singer, singer-songwriter, has a new album out, which is beside the point, but one of the early songs, I think it's Lone Oak, on one of his earlier records, is a murder ballad. And it's sort of like, again, it's sort of a sorry I had to do this to you type thing. And wow. I'm like, it's disturbing when you think about it. It's a beautiful song, but it's absolutely disturbing when you think about it. And there's tons of them.
Right.
We just bought the album for Cattle. Just wanted to put that in there.
Yeah. It's not on that one, though. It's on, I think, Southeastern.
Okay.
For sure. I know the kind of songs you're talking about. Yeah. I remember them from my youth.
Very much. Interesting.
The day my mama got out of prison, she did such and such.
So, yeah. Right. Those types of things. Okay. I mean, it's that type of story. So, but in this case, somebody has been harmed, and the sister is still in danger. And so the deceased sister really wants to save her sister and is able to come back and do that.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
And weirdly, I feel like it ends very well. Okay. Positively for everybody but the bad guy.
Yeah.
So.
Good.
Okay. So this is Maddie. I do have one more book. This is a children's nonfiction book, biography really, Seeds of Discovery, How Barbara McClintock Used Corn and Curiosity to Solve a Science Mystery and Win a Nobel Prize. This is by Lori Alexander, and the art in this book is by Rebecca Santo. Wow, what a fascinating biography. Barbara McClintock was a woman born around the 1900s at some point, and grew up mostly in Brooklyn, but also in other parts of the country. And she was, born at a time when women were not really encouraged, actually discouraged from going off to university, much less getting advanced degrees at university. And her mother in particular was just like, you know, I really wouldn't like it if you went because that's going to lower your chances of getting married. But Barbara McClintock was someone who was very dedicated to her field of botany. And she studied the way corn mutates over time so that it looks differently. If you've ever seen a corn stalk, I have this beautiful picture of her that I copied from Wikipedia because I was so in love with the picture. where the different colors in the grains.
In the kernels.
In the kernels, yes. And so this is what she devoted her life to, is studying that process. And she was someone who had to, like, go from, I mean, I think she got her PhD at Cornell, maybe in 1927, but had to go from university to university and different science labs around the country because she really was not taken all that seriously by, you know, the men who ran the labs and the departments. But she was someone who really mentored other students, had them over. I mean, I'm thinking of professors from Michigan State. Like, I remember them having us over. You know, she had her students over for tea and brownies to talk about deeper science processes. And I think this biography really stood out to me because, I mean, it was just really focused on someone who is just to have such a dedication to one thing and to devote your energy, your study of that way. And I don't, I mean, I'm not quite sure if she saw how important her discoveries, I mean, led to understanding the human, you know, genome project, for example. It was just fascinating to me that she was recognized finally in, I think it was 1983. She was the first woman to win the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. And it was an unshared prize. So finally to see her recognized. The other thing I really like about the book is that, I mean, this is a book, you know, maybe third, fourth, fifth grade. It's a little over 100 pages, but there's just a lot of references to the different sciences that there could be. There's, you know, basic research and compared that to applied research and how one can really influence the other. There's a great glossary in the back as well and a timeline for how this science was established. I really, really enjoyed her. Just her fierce commitment and just reading about her independent way of like, you know, this is what I am. This is who I am. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I really enjoyed this book.
Oh, that looks so good. It reminds me a lot of the Silent Spring book from last year. Yeah. And I feel like these books are so important for kids to grab onto and especially girls to grab onto and say, oh, wow, this is a possibility.
Right.
So I even look back into, you know, I'm Gen X and the turn of this, when I was in school, the science opportunities weren't really presented in a way that was very robust. I wouldn't say that they were saying to me as a girl, don't do science, because there are plenty of girls that did, but it wasn't quite fleshed out in a way that really made it seem like something I could do or would do anything with. And now as an adult looking back, I'm like, wow, I would have probably really enjoyed those things. And I just think even science opportunities for young people, it's good to have that idea of what you can actually do.
Right.
Because I heard about it way later when I knew someone who was working in the sciences and went to school in the sciences and was getting different types of funding than you would for a liberal arts degree.
Sure.
That sort of thing. It's a totally, there's so much you can do with it. Yeah. And how do you know? So it's very inspiring.
I totally agree with you, Cheryl, because I feel like, you know, growing up as a kid, I thought, well, there's nursing and there's being a doctor. What if you don't want to, you know, do those people-focused sort of jobs? I mean, what is research? What do you do with that? And, you know, what kinds of, you know, ways can you support yourself with that? I just thought it was very, very interesting.
You said she won in 83-ish?
She was recognized, with that prize in 1983.
I'm sort of trying to think because I feel like I had more of an idea of that it was a possibility. But I'm
just a little bit younger. So I feel like there was vet, nurse, doctor.
Yes, vet.
And it just wasn't developed. Well, that's really interesting. Well, it looks, and it's a beautiful book.
It is.
It's so aesthetically pleasing.
Great, you know, there's a section on, you know, how x-rays were used in causing mutations and just really neat.
Really, really neat. So cool. Well, I have the last book and it's a little bit, interesting one to try to talk about, but I'll do my best. I loved it. It's one of those books where, you know, I closed the book and I cried. So just to say that doesn't happen to me very often. I'm kind of emotional, but not really about books. They don't make me cry very often. So it was that beautiful, and I felt very personally attached to it. So I'm going to try to do my best to talk about it because the more I love a book, the harder it is for me to talk about on this podcast.
Yep.
But I kept thinking, is anybody going to like this? But I look at the cover and I see it is on the Booker Prize shortlist for 2024. Exactly. So a lot of people liked it, including the Booker Prize committee. It didn't win, but it was on the shortlist.
So this is Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood. And Charlotte Wood is an Australian novelist. Not as many of her books have made it to the United States. So this is a 2025 release in the U.S. And the book is actually set in where Charlotte Wood is actually from, which is part of New South Wales called the Monaro. And it's like these flat lands. And the book is it's not a plot-driven book. So this is going to be a book you're either going to really love or you're going to be like, nothing happens. I don't get it. You know, so definitely pick it up with like a grain of salt or consider that if you want to pick it up. It is not a heavy plot, although there is definitely a plot. So this is a story of an unnamed woman. And I just didn't realize that until I was looking to do research for it today. You never know her name. And you're right with her. It's almost like her journal entries in a way. And so she goes to this convent or an order of nuns that live in New South Wales. And she goes there as almost like, it's almost like a little vacation. You can go there, you can stay in these little spare rooms and just sort of decompress. You can have your meals with them and then you can see the services and you can walk around this spare flat landscape. That's basically what you do. So she does that at a really stressful time in her life. And the next thing you know, reading the book, she's just there. And the way she says it, she kind of drops it on you. I mean, her narrative style is so beautiful. It's so compelling. And you realize, oh, wait, our main character lives here now. We don't exactly know what happened. She was married. She worked for a not-for-profit that was trying to work with endangered animals in Australia. She was, you know, she had a life. She doesn't have that life anymore. She now lives at the convent. She helps them make more interesting food because they were always using like Chef Boyardee type food. And so she's growing food. She's making these, you know, curries and all these things for them, which they sometimes appreciate. And she, there's a little bit of humor. She sort of gets herself into the community. Well, a lot of things start to happen, and it's almost sort of presented in like a religious sort of way. The first one is a plague of mice. And I looked this up. There was a murrain, I learned that word, plague in New South Wales in about 2021. Also, the COVID epidemic comes into this book. The plague of mice is disgusting. It's like the birds, but it's mice. And it's very like horror-ish a little bit, okay, that aspect of it. There's also the bones of a nun who was murdered by a priest in Thailand who used to be part of this order that are coming back. And the woman bringing the bones is someone from our main character's past. This girl who was very, very bullied and had this horrific home life and was just tormented in school. And the main character kind of didn't really defend her, let's put it that way. And that woman is now a nun, and she's an environmental activist. And she's detached from interpersonal relationships, the environmental activist nun, but she's this crusader for environmental causes. I almost think of like a Greta Thunberg or something as a nun, you know, who's like very known around the world as like the face of this environmental movement, but she's got hackles up towards interpersonal relationships. So you have all of this coming together. This is a very quiet story. It's about forgiveness. It's about atonement. It's about very subtly about the climate crisis and environmentalism. It's about what makes a good environmentalist, and also about our main character's grief about losing her parents. And she's one of those people who really never could fully get over her grief, and it intertwined into her life, and also her feelings of failure about her work in the climate movement, kind of intertwined in a way that she decides to retreat. So it's about retreat, and if it's okay to retreat, what does it mean to be a good person? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to forgive? How are the different ways we can do that?
Right.
Are the nuns doing it just as much as she was in the environmental movement because they're using fewer resources and they're living in this very light way? I mean, what are those questions? Asks a lot of questions, doesn't answer that many of them, but it's probably one of the best books I've ever read. So Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood.
Going on the end of the year list.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
So is How to Share an Egg. Yep.
I'm
very different.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
I want to correct something I said earlier, that the song title is Live Oak, not Lone Oak by okay. Jason Isbell. But again, there's lots of different murder ballad songs or murder. Yeah, I guess it's all variations on a theme. But what a lot of interesting books. Okay.
Yeah.
Some I definitely want to read. Some and a lot of flat spaces.
Yes, definitely.
I would say that about Lone Women, too.
Yeah.
And
the fields with the corn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got like a plains thing going on today. Yeah.
Also the without children part.
Yeah.
That occurred to me, too, with Barbara McClintock.
And both of our books had the talks about different saints, which we talked about too, which was really interesting.
Yep.
Two of our books today.
So it's been, okay. We got some stuff going here.
Yeah. We do.
All right. So we will close it out. Lovely to have you listening to us, and we'll see you next month.
Okay. Thank you.